Hi, thanks so much for joining us on this busy day. This is Megan Smith with the Protect Our Care Coalition, and we've brought together top health experts to analyze the latest version of Senate Republicans' health care repeal bill. After brief opening remarks, we'll open the call up for questions. With us, we have Jean Lambrew, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and former deputy assistant to President Obama for health policy, Andy Slavitt, the former acting administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and Aviva Arendine, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and former senior counselor to HHS Secretary Sylvia Burwell. And I'll turn the call over to Aviva now.
Thank you, Megan. You know, we've now been through quite a few rounds of changes to the Congressional Republican Health Bill. Each time, there's a lot of focus on the changes and a lot of speculation about whether they will somehow change the big picture of the bill's impacts. And then each time, when the Congressional Budget Office weighs in, it concludes, no, the bill still causes more than 20 million people to lose coverage, and it still makes coverage worse or less affordable for millions more. That's not an accident. It's because the bill's core features have stayed the same over time. Let me quickly tick through those five core features and where they stand in the current draft, and then Jean will dig deeper on some of the most talked about changes. First, this version of the Senate bill still ends the ACA's expansion of Medicaid that has extended coverage to 11 million low-income adults. In fact, there is nothing in this version of the bill that ameliorates the cuts to expansion at all. What we do have here is a $45 billion fund for opioid and other substance use treatment. But experts have concluded that amount would fall far short of replacing the resources lost from ending Medicaid expansion. What's more, replacing health insurance coverage with state grants will always fall short as a response to the opioid crisis. People struggling with opioid use disorder need access to physical and to mental health care, not just treatment for their addiction. As Senator Capito explained just yesterday, what they need is coverage. Without that, they can't actually access care. Second, this version of the Senate bill still radically overhauls the underlying Medicaid program and caps and cuts federal Medicaid funding for seniors, for people with disabilities, and for families with children. The bill makes some tiny Medicaid changes around the edges, which I'm happy to answer questions about. But the bottom line is the same. It maintains the Medicaid limits and cuts that CBO concluded would bring the bill's total cut to federal Medicaid funding to 35% by 2036. Third, this version of the Senate bill still dramatically increases out-of-pocket premiums and deductibles for moderate-income people buying coverage through the marketplaces, especially older people. As CBO and other experts concluded, the Senate bill would confront most consumers with a choice, pay hundreds or thousands more in premiums, or see your deductibles double to over $6,000. Many older people would actually see their premiums increase, even for those $6,300 deductible plans. Here, Senate Republicans made two changes they claim will help, but both fall far short. First, the bill now allows people to pay individual market premiums through health savings accounts, thereby avoiding income and payroll taxes. That provision mostly adds complexity and hassle for low-income consumers who would save only a few hundred dollars by paying their premiums this way. Its real function is to provide another tax break for upper-income people, many of whom could save thousands of dollars. Second, they've added $70 billion to the bill's State Stability and Innovation Grants. But that money appears to be at least triple counted. First, as Jean will talk about, it's supposed to solve the problems created by the new Cruz Amendment. Second, it's supposed to provide increased reinsurance to mitigate the bill's large increases in sticker price premiums for unsubsidized consumers. And then third, it's somehow supposed to solve the out-of-pocket cost increases for people losing Medicaid coverage or hit by the bill's cuts to financial assistance. But the amount involved is woefully inadequate to any of those purposes. In particular, the state grants for 2022 to 2026 are about 10% of the bill's cuts to Medicaid and to marketplace financial assistance. Fourth, as Jean will talk about in a moment, this version of the Senate bill goes even further than the original in weakening protections for pre-existing conditions. And finally, notwithstanding some changes in this area, this is still a bill that uses cuts to health insurance coverage to pay for hundreds of billions in tax cuts, going mostly to corporations and high-income people. Counting the reported cost of the HSA expansion, the bill now includes about $400 billion in tax cuts, from which low- and middle-income people receive little benefit. This is probably not the last time we'll be looking at a new draft of the Republican bill, and we may see more changes in the coming days, whether that's delays of some provisions or additions of more small pots of money that are supposed to address discrete issues. But in evaluating those changes, the question should be, do they undo the 5 structural flaws in the bill? If not, they are not going to change the bill's big picture impacts. With that, I'll turn this over to Jean.
Thanks, Aviva. And I'm just going to talk about this new infusion of funds for the long-term state stability and innovation program, which shorthand I'll call the innovation program, and what the Senate bill means for people with pre-existing conditions. So to start out, the revised bill pumps about $70 billion over 10 years, or about a 60% increase into this fund for a total of $182 billion. As Aviva noted, first, it's important to note that this is a small fraction of the cuts in health spending in the bill. It also is double, if not triple, counted. The talking points for the bill talk about this new infusion of funds being used for, quote, state-based reforms, unquote, but that total amount of $70 billion in new funds is also potentially dedicated to the Cruz Amendment to try to offset its higher premiums. As such, it really is more than advertised, or the advertising is more than the actual impact. Second, it is an extraordinary transfer of spending power from Congress to the administration. For perspective, the innovation program has more funding but less congressional guidance than the entire Children's Health Insurance Program, which is widely viewed as striking a good federal-state balance. As such, Secretary Price has the authority to, among other things, earmark funding for insurance companies or high-risk pools or health savings accounts, regardless of what a state may need. He alternatively could allocate funding to states and do so on an ad hoc basis, since there is no formula in the bill except for a special earmark of 1% of the funding for states with high premiums. Nothing prevents Secretary Price, for example, from providing his home state of Georgia with more funding than he does to states that oppose the legislation. And even if he were to allocate funding in year one in a way that a particular governor may like, he could, in the next year or subsequent years, reallocate that funding away from states with no explanation required. And third, the decision-making authority for this fund is solely with the administration, not with governors. The bill allows states to propose uses for the funds, but only, quote, as specified by the administration. In other words, Secretary Price has unlimited authority to say no to a state's request. So this is unprecedented authority for this size of dollars, and as a note, the Secretary would also decide which states get how much of the $45 billion included in the bill for opioid treatment, mental health, and substance use disorder treatment. So it may sound cynical to assume that these unfederal funds would be allocated in these ways, but as a reminder, this is the same administration that has been willing to drive up premiums and drive out insurance companies from the marketplace by threatening to stop cost-sharing subsidies and enforcement of the individual mandate. So any governor or insurance company that's counting on these funds to solve their problems should be warned. Second, let's talk about the bill's impact on people with pre-existing conditions. The so-called Cruz Amendment, which is attached at the end of this bill, is largely as advertised. It would allow insurance companies to offer unregulated plans so long as they also offer qualified health plans. And like the House bill, the so-called Upton Amendment, the Senate bill does now include a big bulk of funding that I just described to offset the inevitable premium increases that result by segregating people with pre-existing conditions from those without them. But I think it's important to note that even without the Cruz Amendment, the underlying Senate bill does remove protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Under the changes made to the state innovation waivers, insurers could offer plans with and without key benefits, effectively creating high-risk pools. Plans could return to even higher deductibles and co-pays for consumers, making health care unaffordable for people with pre-existing conditions. And unlike the Cruz Amendment, there may not even be the option for people to buy plans that cover essential health benefits with maternity benefits or high-cost drug coverage, because the state could waive those service requirements entirely. In the words of CBO, the agencies expect that insurance coverage for some for high-cost services will become extremely expensive in those areas, as it was in some places before the enactment of the ACA in 2010, end quote, and that's without the Cruz Amendment. Lastly, a less noticed provision in the Senate bill is its so-called small business health plans. The bill allows an insurer to set up in one state to self-employ people and to small businesses in any state and to medically underwrite those premiums without the requirement that they cover essential health benefits. It's the same old story, returning to a situation where insurance companies can segregate those who are healthy and those who are at risk of needing care, resulting in higher premiums for some and inadequate coverage for others. So, in short, even if the Cruz Amendment were dropped, the Senate bill is still a mean bill, too. And with that, I'll turn it over to Andy.
Thank you, Jean. So let me start by taking a look at what we have in summary here in the Senate repeal bill released today. It's basically the same as their last disastrous bill. And in critical ways, it's even worse. First of all, it guts Medicaid by more than $2 trillion over the next two decades and eliminates Medicaid expansion. The many senators who've expressed concern over this are going to be incredibly hard-pressed to support anything that continues down that disastrous path. Second, it also strips health care from people with disabilities, seniors in nursing homes, and other vulnerable populations. It still devastates our ability to combat the opioid epidemic. It still means that tens of millions will have their health coverage taken away. It still lets insurance companies charge up to five times more for people over 50. And it still defunds Planned Parenthood. It still allows insurance companies to reimpose annual and lifetime limits, importantly, including for people who receive coverage through their employer, and to make coverage for pre-existing conditions unaffordable. And it still increases people's premiums and deductibles, especially for older people, especially for low-income people, especially for those with illnesses. And now, in addition, high-deductible plans, one of the chief criticisms the GOP had of the ACA, are embraced. The bill is so fundamentally flawed that there is no amendment that could fix everything that is wrong with it. I think this is the most important point of all. There is no amendment that would mean Republican senators would not be breaking the promises they've made to their constituents back home. As you all know, we expect Leader McConnell will have the Senate vote on the motion to proceed next Tuesday. Maybe that even slips a day to Wednesday. But either way, this is the essential vote. Any senator who cares about the health and financial security of their constituents must vote no on the motion to proceed. There's nothing in here for those moderate Republicans who promise their constituents to protect their care. Nothing they can stand on to defend a yes vote. Republican senators like Shelley Moore Capito, Bill Cassidy, Lindsey Graham, and Ron Johnson have talked about the need for Democrats and Republicans to work together, that we should strengthen the marketplace. But to do that, those senators will also need to vote against the motion to proceed. Senators have another decision to make on the motion to proceed. And that is the following question. Are they willing to vote for a bill that they deem good enough for the American public, but not good enough for them? The bill exempts Congress from cuts in essential health benefits. This is an important symbol of outrage to ordinary American families who will lose their most important protections. And who knows what other hidden things are in this bill that senators would have to live with. So like we saw in the House with the hastily drafted Upton Amendment, there's a real possibility that this bill does make it to the Senate floor, is amended, and that senators will vote on a final bill that the CBO and that the American people haven't been given a chance to review. Republicans are setting up a vote on a final bill that could affect tens of millions of families, every state's budget, one-sixth of our economy, without knowing the full extent of its disastrous effects. That's unacceptable. There's also growing concern that Republicans may try to do an end run around the CBO in the coming days by relying on the Trump administration itself to be its own referee to provide a substitute score. We don't believe this should be trusted in the least. We are disturbed that what we're seeing is an unprecedented attack from Republicans, funded by taxpayers, on the very nonpartisan, rigorous policy analysis that our country depends on. As the public servant in charge of setting thoughtful policy affecting the health insurance of one in three Americans, I cannot overstate how irresponsible this is. We need neutral referees. We need an apples-to-apples comparison of policy ideas so that we know when one works compared to another. So in closing, this bill is a disaster. Americans deserve better. Nothing has changed in this bill, and there's nothing that's fixable about it. Senators need to vote no on the motion to proceed.
Thanks, Andy. Operator, can we open up the lines for questions now, please?
Thank you. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There will be a delay before the first question is announced. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. And once again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. And our first question comes from Dimmitt Cole.
Yes. How exactly would the Cruz Amendment lead to a situation where the essential benefits, market would decline?
Sure. So in the Cruz Amendment, they list what are called non-applicable provisions. And those non-applicable provisions include the essential health benefits. So it would be an insurance company's choice that if, again, they do offer a qualified health plan, a silver and gold plan, a high-deductible health plan, silver or gold plan in the marketplace, they would be able to offer a plan without the essential health benefits requirement plus a number of others, such as the guaranteed availability requirement, limitations on waiting periods, prohibition on discrimination by health status, and preventive services requirements. So there's 9 provisions that an insurance company would no longer have to apply to its unregulated plans if it's also offering a regulated plan.
Well, I guess my question is, how then would the existence of that kind of system, why do you think that would lead to much higher costs for people with pre-existing conditions?
Because the people who have a pre-existing condition would be denied, could be denied coverage or could choose not to buy the unregulated plan because it doesn't cover the services they need, the amendment would guarantee that they get access to a regulated plan. And so people would sift and sort themselves into the unregulated plan, which may have lower premiums for people who are healthy, less benefits, but lower premiums. The people with pre-existing conditions would go to the regulated plans, which would, by definition, have more of the sick people, have higher premiums, and because the waivers allow the insurance companies to base the premiums for the regulated plans on those enrollees, premiums would be higher.
Thank you. And once again, if you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. And we have a question from Liz Refkin.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay, there we go. Hi. I was wondering what you thought of the Alaska carve-out for the stabilization funds and how that compares to what Alaska has now.
Let me start, and others can jump in. This is Aviva. First, just to explain the provision you're referring to for others, this is a provision in the stabilization fund language that requires that at least 1% of the funds be reserved for states with a characteristic that only describes Alaska, so effectively for Alaska. That is considerably higher than the share of that fund that Alaska might get if it was allocated based on enrollment or based on claims or based on other sort of standard criteria one might use. Your question is how Alaska would fare under the combination of the bill's other provisions and this provision. The answer is that Alaska would still lose big from this bill as a whole. That's because it's hit very hard by both the Medicaid provisions of the bill and exceptionally hard, the hardest hit state, by the marketplace provisions. On the Medicaid side, I believe the Alaska Department of Health and Human Services has estimated that Alaska would lose $3.1 billion in funding just from the bill's Medicaid cuts. That substantially exceeds what it would receive from the stabilization fund. On top of that, it would be particularly hard hit by the bill's effective elimination of Medicaid expansion. And in fact, Alaska's expansion could be in legal jeopardy as early as 2020. Even though cuts in the rest of the country would not start until a year later, so Alaska would be uniquely harmed by that provision. On the marketplace side, precisely because of Alaska's high costs, its consumers would be the hardest hit by losing tax credits altogether for people between 350 and 400% of poverty, and they would also be the hardest hit by the provision that slashes tax credits for everybody, indexing them to a bronze plan rather than a silver plan. While consumers everywhere would have to pay more in premiums if they wanted to buy up to more generous coverage, that extra cost would be greatest in a high-cost state like Alaska. And again, the Stability Fund isn't going to offset those cuts. There are also other areas where Alaska is particularly hit, for example, the impact on the tribal population. And if you put the full picture together, those impacts are not at all offset by this fund, which on top of that, is, you know, double, triple, quadruple allocated to multiple purposes, as Jean talked about. In particular, it's supposed to be addressing the harms from the Cruz Amendment in Alaska, but then somehow also offsetting the other cuts. The final point I would make about that provision is just that, you know, other states might want to take a look, because there are other high-cost states as well that do not get that special allocation from the Stability Fund. If they got a similar guarantee, that would lead to much, you know, that would significantly increase their funding levels. And so I imagine that's something that, you know, other states may be taking a look at over the coming days. I don't know if Jean or Andy wants to add anything.
Nope.
I think you got it.
Thank you. And next we have a question from Sarah Hansert.
Hi, thank you. This is Sarah Hansert with Bloomberg BNA. Aviva, you talked about other high-cost states might want to get extra funding. What states are you thinking of in particular, and I don't know, any particular amounts of funding?
Well, to start with the amounts, it looks like the Alaska allocation in the bill is several times what it would receive if the funds were allocated based on, for example, claims costs in the individual market. So any other state looking at that allocation might think that, you know, its funding should also go up. Other states that also have high premiums and therefore are also sort of particularly harmed by some of the bill's cuts to tax credits include West Virginia, Tennessee, Wyoming, South Dakota, Arizona. All of those are other high-cost states that, you know, are not as affected as Alaska, but are also more affected than the average state by the cuts to premium tax credits.
And once again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. And we have a question from Elizabeth Crisp.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was kind of curious if you could speak a little bit, too. It seems like one of the changes in this version versus the previous version is that some of the funds they've shifted from Medicaid enrollment to being based on a state's uninsured population?
Yes, there's a change in the funding formula for DSH payments related to hospital uncompensated care to base them more on the number of uninsured people rather than the number of Medicaid enrollees. That's a change that advantages states that did not expand Medicaid relative to states that did expand Medicaid, and that seems to be the intention to shift more of those funds to non-expansion states. It could also serve as an incentive, effectively, for states to drop their expansions and leave more people uninsured even sooner than would otherwise occur under the bill. So it seems problematic in that respect. That said, even non-expansion states, which are sometimes talked about as if they were, you know, less harmed by this bill, are still deeply hurt by the other Medicaid cuts resulting from the cap on the rest of the Medicaid program, as well as from the cuts to subsidies that result in premium and deductible increases.
And this is Jean. I just might add that, going back to Aviva's earlier point, if I'm a governor and I'm looking at this bill, this is not fundamentally different than what I saw before. They made basically no changes to the policy on expansion. So governors have the so-called choice of continuing the expansion but paying 2.8 to 5 times more to do so. It still places a per capita cap on the Medicaid program, forcing governors to make the hard choices of cutting payments to providers, cutting benefits, or cutting coverage. And by cutting subsidies and eliminating the individual mandate, insurance companies would likely be fleeing their states unless they sought one of these waivers for essential health benefits or maximum out-of-pocket costs. So governors would be forced to either harm people with pre-existing conditions, reinstate the mandate, or fund on their own the tax credit cuts that are in this bill, or let insurance companies leave their states. So I just think we should keep an eye on the big picture here, which is these are all very small changes in the latest version of the Senate bill that don't change the calculus that a lot of governors have previously said is a bad deal for states.
Thank you. And as one final reminder, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone, and please state which outlet you are with before asking your question. And we do have another question from Dimmitt Cole.
Yeah, it's Dermot Coles, Alaska Dispatch News. Just to follow up on that thing about this stability fund, that I've seen some published reports saying it could be several hundred million a year, or a few hundred million a year, I guess, for Alaska. Is that, do you have any idea how much this would be?
So there's about $180 billion in the fund total, and so a 1% guarantee is theoretically a guarantee of $1.8 billion over 10 years. But it's important to note what Gene talked about, which is much of that funding is not for states. It's for insurers, and it's specifically for insurers that are offering the non-compliant plans allowed under the Cruz Amendment. So it's apples and oranges to take that $1.8 billion and compare it to, for example, the $3.1 billion Medicaid cut or the hundreds of millions in cuts to marketplace subsidies in Alaska, because those are funds that are going directly through the state budget to get people coverage, as opposed to these funds, with a large fraction of which are bookmarked to just try to undo some of the damage to people with pre-existing conditions from allowing insurers to go back to their old practices in the individual market. So a much smaller fraction of those funds would ever be available for people's coverage.
Yeah, and I would even downplay it more, because $50 billion of that $182 billion is going to insurance companies for reinsurance. And under the Cruz Amendment, $70 billion would not go to states. Instead, it would go straight from Health and Human Services to insurance companies that decide to offer these unregulated plans. So knocking off $120 billion, the percentage allocation that might get to Alaska would be smaller. And again, I'll go back to the fact that without any congressional rules for the allocation of these funds, Secretary of Health and Human Services could choose even to have less than that amount go to states.
So instead of $180 billion, what would, any idea what that number would be knocked down to, roughly?
I mean, even of the money supposedly going to states, they take $5 billion out for, say $5 billion has to go for insurance companies. So I think you're down to about $57 billion if you take out $55 billion for reinsurance and $70 billion for the Cruz Amendment. That might be available for states, and even then the Secretary could lower that if he decides to allocate more towards different purposes.
So this could be on the low side, a few hundred million over 10 years, or is even that speculative?
Correct. With a state match, as a reminder, because by 2026, Alaska will have to come up with 35% to be able to access those funding.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. And we have no further questions at this time. And do our speakers have any final remarks?
Well, I don't know if Gene or Aviva have any closing remarks, but I just want to emphasize that we are these insights we've given you are based upon a couple of hours of reading the bill. It's incredibly disturbing to continue to find things hidden that I think are just continuing to get discovered, and some of these impacts won't be analyzed and won't be able to be analyzed for weeks. So as it sits today, based on everything we know, this bill is unsupportable and unfixable, and it should be even more concerning that senators are being asked to be put in a position to make decisions that are going to have a major impact in their states and on their constituents, when there are doubtlessly hidden other benefits and interactions like the type that Gene just laid out here, which makes it a lot different than meets the eye. So we think it's critical that those senators who have made very public statements about what they will not support understand that in the run-up to the vote on the motion to proceed, that there's no possible way that they'll be able to keep their word if they vote yes on the motion to proceed. But Gene and Aviva, if you have any other closing thoughts, I'd leave mine there.
Nope, I second that.
Likewise.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.